Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. En route, on location, on the go. Let ICOM help you take ham radio on the road. For more information, visit ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation and by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay only for what you use. Ting doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one shared plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit hamnation.ting.com. That's hamnation.ting.com.
This is Ham Nation, episode 138 for March 12th, 2014, a world-class contest station.
Good evening, everybody. It's K9EID, and I'm back. I've been gone, but I've been having a lot of fun. And we're going to have a great show tonight. Got some really good guests from Connecticut that have had their license 3 years. But wait till you see what Anita and Fred have done. Oh, my gracious. Built this incredible station, and we want to talk about it. And George, you're doing well. In a great show last week. You doing okay?
Yeah, doing fine, Bob. We're going to talk a little bit tonight. What are we talking about? I don't even remember now. It was kind of one of those things I pulled out of the hat real quick, but I'm sure it's going to be fine. But we are going to talk about this stuff right here little bit. I got some treat from Australia that I want to share with you.
Okay. Gordon, it quit raining and things are good in the Costa Mesa?
They are. In fact, we actually had time to play antennas. Look what we have for Dayton, 1,000 QSL cards for those attending the Ham Nation get-together at Dayton. KB3 IFH was good enough to donate those. Also, Bob, the gang at Off-Road Ham, they are going to be looking for us, and they want to make sure that Don and I and others, including you, wear their Off-Road Ham hat. Bob in New York with WWWRF Finder, Bob W2CYK, has now got together with Radio Amateurs of Canada with his unique repeater database. Speaking of repeaters, you can't have enough in your handheld. This coming weekend, Saturday, we're doing the Palm Springs Ham Fest, and Clint is going to be programming radios. He found there's quite a business among those with Chinese hard-to-program radios to get them programmed. Mm-hmm. So all this weekend will be on Saturday at the Palm Springs Ham Fest, enjoying all the activities there. So if you're local, I'll see you in Palm Springs. Bob, back to you.
Okay, and the weather's a lot better there than it is in Buffalo, New York tonight. Oh, gosh. It's great in the Ozarks. So, man, it was 80 yesterday, and it's going to be 70 so through the weekend here. So what can I tell you? Well, I want to let people know where I was. I get so many emails, and I love it. Just keep them coming. I try to answer all of you. But I was down in Greene County, Oklahoma, at the Greene County Ham Fest in Claremore, Oklahoma. Here's a few slides, and we'll run through these real quick, Brian, and we'll let you see what happened at this great ham fest. First of all, I stopped in Miami and, of course, played the Mighty Wurlitzer. It was fun. Always fun to go to the theater there. It's so good, the Coleman. And we'll tell you more about that later. It's a fabulous instrument. And then we trucked on down I-44 and started setting up for the Ham Fest. And boy, I tell you, I think it's the largest Ham Fest in Oklahoma. Here they were just starting to set up. That was just a setup. And I mean, this place is loaded. Associated Radio was there from Kansas City. And they always have a nice display. And then Mark and Tammy were there from Paris, Texas, MTC.
All right.
Great dealer. Yeah, and good old Gene and Galen, WB0W. That's about a third of their booth. Their booth's usually about 150 foot long, and I mean that. Now I want you to look at that. I thought that was very cool. Was right out in front selling our books, Gordo, is the Bible. They sell that, and they sell a lot of them. And here are some of the parts. I just look at all some of the things that were there. Good stuff. Usually it's just a bunch of nonsense, but man, there were a lot of nice radios and wonderful amplifiers, tons of it. And look, there was a scope for $30, everybody. Look at that ancient, good old Yaesu FL-2500. On and on. I was very impressed with some of these. Yeah, you had some of this too. You always have to have that, you know. Clean out your Tupperware bins in the garage. Look at that beautiful Heathkit station. Oh, my. That's such a nice piece. That whole station is really great. And then radio clubs are there. Tulsa, of course, is just down the road. And Tulsa has a nice club. Good guys and gals. And then we did a workshop, and there was about 80 in there, standing room only around the back, and we appreciate that. But I love so much sharing the hobby, sharing the science, sharing the fun, and that's what we do. We do a lot of it. There's some of my gang from 160 meters. Now, this is really cool, guys. We've talked to these people for a long time. We're talking probably two decades and have never met. And that's what Hamfests are all about for me, is meeting Doug and Maida and Dick, and we had never met until that Hamfest. So that's always cool. And you want to try to go to your local Hamfest, and you just run into a lot of good things. Well, talk about good things. Gordo's got a bunch of it. So we're going to head back to Costa Mesa. And Gordon West, it's all yours.
All right. Well, we got my antenna fixed, and we got Patrick's antenna fixed. So, Ryan, if you want to go ahead and roll the antenna pictures, this is the setup that Patrick presented, and it's an off-center fed Wyndham. And an off-center fed Wyndham is a dipole, but it's like one-third, two-thirds, a long side and a short side, fed at the high current point, about 200 to 400 ohms, so you need a 4-to-1 or a 2-to-1 balun. And it wasn't working just like it should be. So we went up the ladder, and, you know, we've had great successes with radio waves as well as radio works. Both these companies make wonderful off-center fed Wyndhams. And the off-center fed Wyndham is a unique dipole because it works when properly operating 40, 30, 20, 15, and 10 meters. Sometimes 15 will come in, and sometimes you may need the help of a manual or an automatic antenna tuner. But it's an all-band antenna. And this was the radio waves I brought along just in case we couldn't get the other one to work. So we took a look, and we do all of our measurements of these antenna projects on the roof. So have your MFJ SWR analyzer. You'll see that I've got the battery pack because the internal batteries gave up the ghost after a couple of months. And there's my little Yaesu FT817, and that's the three main pieces of gear that we're going to need. Now, we had good coax feeding the antenna, so that was not why it wasn't really loading up on each band as advertised. And luckily, we didn't have any of these. These will get you into trouble, everybody. Get rid of those coax splices because water will get in and you've got a bad connection. We looked at all the PL259s, and we're going with a bigger coax. Even though we don't need the big coax for HF, we still like to run good-sized coax to minimize the losses. All right, what do you see here? Well, he's got a lot of antennas, but there's a dipole going off to the left on the short side and off to the right. But take a look at the feed point. It was too close to the metal mast. Well, we had a hard time trying to separate it from the metal mast. We couldn't really work too well on each end of the dipole because that's like a 100-foot drop, and I didn't want to get next to each end of the dipole. But Patrick, KF6PFW, he had all of his rigging gear, and he was all roped in, and he had no problem. And the ends of the dipole, we found, were not causing the problem next to the metal rain gutter. And you'll see that Patrick was well-equipped for this little adventure to the edge of the roof. So our big deal was get the feed point away from the metal mast, and that left side wire, we had to reposition that to get it away from the mast, and we still didn't have complete success. So here's the cure. Take a look below the anemometer. See that white tube? That comes from Radio Works, and that is a line isolator. And once we got the line isolator in, now that dipole tuned up on 80, 40, 20, sort of on 15 and 10 meters. And I think Patrick was working Japan right off the bat on 10. So you have to play around with an off-center fed Windom antenna because it's very particular as to how you have it placed and what's around it to get it to load up. Well, we had noise. We couldn't figure out where the noise was coming from. Soon as we snapped off the breakers of his place, luckily, the noise went away. Guess what we found? Went into the kitchen, and that's Patrick. He brought out a little charger and his cell phone extra battery and solar deal. This little charger that you see in his left hand, this little guy did not have a CE approval on it. It gave out so much noise throughout the HF band that it wreaked havoc. Once we unplugged it, the noise instantly went away. And as you can see, he's a happy camper working as a volunteer for CERT and his local emergency team. Well, now over at my antenna, my 15 meters and 20 meters were really acting squirrely, and I couldn't figure out, but I knew I had to lower that big beam antenna. So lowered the beam antenna, got on the roof, took out my SWR analyzer, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, but I knew it was probably the trap. What a trap is a high Q, a coil, and a capacitance over the coil. And this would be a parallel trap, and the trap is trapping out one particular band. Well, since the 15-meter band was giving me all the troubles affecting the other lower HF bands, 40 as well as 20, I took down the trap, looked at it carefully, looked it up again, made sure the drain holes were down, bless the trap, and it still was intermittent. And I thought, well, what would make a trap intermittent? So we undid the hose clamps and wiggled them around. I had all the good goosh in there that's conductive. That was not the problem. So I tried the other end of the trap, all new hose clamps, wiggled it around, metered it out. That was not the problem. So what can go wrong with a trap? Well, did it have water in it? I was prepared to remove these little black plastic pieces that on this Cushcraft were already split open as they were. We looked at the coil, and the coil itself was okay. Metered it out. We then took a closer look. Yep, metered it out again. Everything was okay. What is wrong with this trap? We looked at one end of the trap, and this is the capacitive side, the X of C of the trap. We see it held into place, no water on the inside. And then I started wiggling the trap. And I wiggled some more. There it is. Look at that little screw. That's hidden by the black mask over it. So if you've got a trap antenna and the trap antenna wiggles when you turn it, here's the problem. This piece of junk screw, absolutely no Loctite in it, and every single one on this beam antenna, I could take 1.5 turns. So am I happy? You got it. So again, let's take a look at this. Here is the trap. And here, if you have the Cushcraft antennas, this is the little screw right here that can get you into trouble. And notice that the trap wiggles. You can hear it wiggle. That's it. So the trap was good. The problem is this little black doodad covering the screw, you would never know that it's not riveted, but rather a piece of junk screw. And I hope that MFJ that's taken over Cushcraft will now do a better job of dogging down that screw. So I'm happy. We're on the air on both Patrick's system as well as our own. And I can't wait to hear from the next team coming up on this cast as to all the great DX sets out there, Bob. So, Bob, back to you.
Hey, that was great. And those are the little things that you don't ever count on. You just have to go out and check them. And hey, Gordo, what's the most important thing that you had as far as test equipment? Would you say it was the MFJ analyzer? Is that the thing that really helped?
You know, it really does. The MFJ analyzer makes for instant checking, and you take it up on the roof and have a spare battery for it. And if you don't want to spend $300, look at this. MFJ still makes a HF one. This is the VHF one, but they make an HF one for $99. So having a portable antenna analyzer on the roof, so you don't have to run back and forth and back and forth, is the way to go with any kind of an outside antenna. Back to you, Bob.
Have to have it. George, you agree, don't you? If somebody said you get one piece of test gear, that would be it probably, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what I've got in my hand right here. And we're going to talk about that a little later. I finally remembered what I'm doing tonight. So, and it's using this.
Okay, cool. You have been running around with Tommy too much. I can tell you that right now. And if you guys don't know what we're talking about, you better go check out Amateur Logic. You'll see what we mean. Well, I am very excited to be able to bring two really great ham radio operators to the show tonight. I've heard about them for some time, and I finally wrote them an email and said, help. We need to talk about what you're doing. So, everybody, this is a wonderful couple, and let's meet Fred and Anita, AB1OC and AB1QB. Greetings. How are you tonight?
We're doing great, Bob. Thanks for the opportunity to be on the show.
Well, we need about 6 hours to tell everybody what you did, but very quickly, first of all, I understand you're both engineers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Anita and I are both trained electrical engineers. I'm in software and communications, and Anita's a project manager right now.
Wow, that's great. And what brought you to ham radio? Why did you want to get into this wonderful hobby?
Well, it's really the other way around. I guess ham radio is the reason that I got into engineering. I had an uncle that was Yay. Really involved in shortwave listening. And he got me interested in radio and wanted to be a ham really bad, but couldn't quite pull it off when I was younger, didn't have a good mentor. So a little ways back, we realized we could get a license, and we did it. Anita followed suit, and here we are.
Yeah, how many times have we heard the same story that ham radio brought us to our careers? Well, we want to show some of these pictures of this great station. So, Brian, if you just want to start them up, I'll give you a couple of little goes ahead. So let her happen. And if Fred and Anita, one of you, tell us what we see here.
All right. This was really the first element of our station that we built. Our station's in a below ground in a basement. And we started out working on the grounding, the drainage, cable entries and all that good infrastructure stuff, made sure we had all that right. And what you see here is a result of that work. This is set up to handle about 10 antennas, and it sits literally on the opposite side of the wall from the shack we're sitting in now.
All right. Looks like you did it right. Go ahead.
Yep. So we built a dedicated room for our shack in the corner of our basement. I guess doing this is like any other basement remodeling project, except for some what I call ham elements. This is an example of some of that. We built the back wall of our shack about a foot thick so we could put conduits in it to get cables and so on from the ceiling to the floor. You can see we have a tremendous number of outlets in here, all rated 20 amps or higher. Again, extra power for all the amateur radio stuff. Here's a view of the framed out room for the shack. A couple things are of interest here. You notice one of the first things we did before we finished the room was to tape out where our planned operating desk was. We brought chairs in the room and kind of moved around and tried to make sure everything was going to be comfortable and easy to work in. The heavy strapping that's a few feet above the floor is attachment points for the brackets that will later hold the operating desk. Our desk here is mostly freestanding, and we needed that extra extra support in order to hold everything up. And you can see
so
the generous
well thought out
and stuff in here. One of the other elements of our shack is we put in a dedicated breaker panel, 125 amps of service. Everything in the shack is all at one easy, convenient spot outside the room. And we've done this sort of plywood backboard thing for a number of infrastructure projects we've done in the past. Right now, we're in the process of building an automated antenna switching system on this board. You can see there's outlets and everything you would need to work out in this area of the station. Here's a view of the room as it's nearly finished. You can see the operating desk, freestanding. The brackets underneath have large holes in them that will provide a nice place to route our cables. You can see the desk has cutouts to get cables from the ceiling to the floor and an area in back of each operating position that's big enough for me to stick my head up in and work on the back of the radios. Here's a view of another corner of the shack. We put in a dedicated heat pump and air conditioning unit. I did a heat calculation early on and realized this was going to be a pretty toasty room with all the computers and amplifiers and all that good stuff. We plan for a lot of storage, drawers and cabinets, and of course they're all full in our shack, but it does help keep the place neat. And we paid a lot of attention to safety. You can see the wired fire alarm system. There are fire extinguishers outside the room as well. So try to think a little bit about the worst case. Here's another interesting ham feature. We built in antenna switching consoles. The ones on the left are for our UHF stack from 144 megahertz up to 23 centimeters. The ones on the right are a temporary console that we're using for switching our HF antennas. This transmit antennas. This allows us to assign any of our antennas to any of the four radios in the station. The last thing we paid a lot of attention to were grounds end to end. The outside grounds, which we saw in the first picture, each operating position has four rods wired in a star. The heavy cable you see on the right of this ground block comes straight through the foundation walls. It's literally only a foot long between where it connects to the rod and where it connects to these single point grounds, which sit in back of our station. This makes it really easy to get everything grounded properly. The other major element of our station construction was putting in a new 100-foot tower and to cover quite a range of bands, which we'll talk about in a minute. A lot of the early part of this project was coordinating contractors, and I'll let Anita talk a little bit about what was involved in doing that.
First of all, we had a contractor to do all the excavation so that we could put in the conduit to put all the cables through. That's what our lawn looked like initially, but now it's covered with snow, but it's all back to normal now. Okay, and then it was time to bring the ready mix truck in. We had to get line up a contractor for that to pour the foundation for the tower.
Anytime that you work on towers, it's important to have good safety gear and know how to use it. Here's a picture of me all ready to climb. You can see the safety harness with the safety attachments, the hard hat, eye protection, and tool belt to carry all my goodies up there so I can work, and ropes as I go up to the tower to set up a line to pull things up and down. This is a view of our tower as it was going up. We put up a 100-foot Rome 55G tower, and we had help from Matt Strelo and Andrew at XX Towers to do this part of our project. Given we had never put a tower up before and doing such an involved project, we decided to get some professional help. A lot of the viewers here probably heard of a gin pole. You can see one in operation here. That thing that looks like a pipe on the left side of the tower is being used to hoist the next 10-foot section of Rome 55G up into place on the tower. One of the unique features of our tower is its star guide. Instead of having one guy anchor per corner of the tower, we have two, along with special brackets for attaching them. And what this does is it increases the torque capacity of the tower. We have two very large step IR Yagis on here. They weigh each a couple hundred pounds. And when they both start and stop in the opposite directions at the same time, it puts quite a torque load on the tower. The star guys help to deal with that.
That's something that you don't see a lot of, but that's really great. And I hope that the audience is paying attention to what's happening there. Because you get these big antennas, they'll twist the tower. And a lot of times it'll just twist that baby into the ground. That's just so well thought out. Just super. Just super.
One of the first rules of tower work that we learned the hard way is that you really don't want to assemble anything in the air that you can assemble on the ground. Here's a picture of that tower section you just saw before it went on the tower. And you can see the star guy brackets all bolted up to the tower and ready to go up there before it went up, all of the attaching points for the guy wires were put in place and so on. So again, the minimal amount of work to be done in the air is what you always want to do when you're working on a tower. Here's a picture of one of the three guy equalizers. We have two levels of guys, one at about 50 foot, the other one close to 100. Because of the star guys, we actually have two sets of guy lines for each level at each anchor point instead of four. And what this plate basically does is equalizes the load on the concrete anchor block that's buried in the ground on the left. It's also very, very important to pay good attention to lightning grounding when you're putting a tower up. This was the view at the end of the first day, even though we only had about 60 or 70 feet up. We did drive one ground rod. It got the tower grounded. As the tower was finished, we added ground rods to all three legs, bonded those to the station grounds and then to the electrical grounds in the station. Here's a picture of the completed tower looking down from the 100-foot level. You can see the lower stepper DB36 down there at 65 feet on a rotating ring. Just above my head is the second antenna just like that, and above that are UHF antennas for 2 meters and 432 that are on a 20-foot mast. And, of course, there's Anita on the ground. She's my ground crew, and she's wearing all of her safety equipment.
That's great.
Here's a picture of Anita operating a contest. Let me let you describe this piece a little bit. Okay.
Yeah, so this gives you an idea of how everything gets pulled together at the end of the project so that we can operate. We put a lot of thought into the layout of the station because when you're operating, especially in a contest, you want to make your coups as quickly. You want everything close at hand. You can see we have two monitors, and they're on basically coming out of the wall. They're adjustable stands. Below that, we have two ICOM radios, the 9100 and the 7800, and then our amplifier controller in front of that. And then to the left are all the controls for the rotator and the antennas. And we're running software. You can see that's N1MM contesting software, and it's automates everything. So I can just like click my mouse in the right place, and it'll tune to a station. It'll rotate the antenna all from within the software.
That's really, really nice stuff.
Yeah, here's a little closer view of the antenna controls. The three stepper controllers on the right, in addition to the two Yagis, we have a big IR vertical in the station, the two rotor controllers. The stuff on the upper right are the stack controls. The steppers can either be used together, in or out of phase, or be split apart. So I can each take one and not have to fight over antennas. The stuff on the left is an 8-circle steerable vertical receive array for the low bands. That helps our performance a lot on 160 and 80 meters. And then finally, here's a panorama of the completed station. You can see kind of the whole setup and the space underneath the on the desk. We've done about 30,000 contacts out of here in the little over 18 months since the station's been completed. We keep a blog that explains all of the construction of the station and what we went through and how we did it and so on. And I guess that's pretty much the story.
It's typically what an engineer would do to build a station, and I appreciate that when you're putting all these things together. Just a gorgeous way to do this. And how long did it take you to plan this? When did you start planning this, Fred?
Well, the station planning began probably about a year and a half before we actually started construction. I kind of did a little bit of it as we go along. The first thing was a lot of layouts of the room and the shack itself. We started building that about a year ago, I guess 2 years ago now. It would be almost in December. And then round about the middle of the year, the tower planning started, and we did a lot of detailed work on that to figure out how to space the antennas. Our tower actually covers all the ham bands from 160 meters all the way through up, including 432, all the way up through 70 centimeters. And to get that many different multiband antennas to work well on a single tower was a real engineering challenge.
Well, it sure looks great. A couple of questions from the chat room. What kind of rotor and controllers do you have?
Yeah, the upper, great question. The upper rotor is an M2 Orion, and the lower rotor is a K0XG rotating ring. It's a giant piece. The ring weighs almost 600 pounds. I think you could turn just about any antenna on Earth with it. Our rotor controllers are Green Heron RT21s. And we're in the process of integrating them and all of our stepper controllers into a micro ham automation system that's going in now. As a matter of fact, the top post on my blog, if anyone cares to take a look at that, at the it's on the footer on the bottom of the screen, is all about what we're doing with the micro ham stuff to integrate all this a little bit better.
And one other great question from one of the guys in the chat room. How much land do you have there? And did you have a lot of problem with regulations or HOAs or things like that?
Yeah, great question. Now, this is one of the good luck stories of our amateur radio career. We have about a little over 3 acres here. A lot of the lot is wooded and not all that usable for anything other than small antennas. When we put our tower up, we were fortunate our local building inspector, who's a pretty good friend of ours from all the remodeling work we've done here, knew about PRB1 and pretty much told the ordinance people in town that they had to allow us to put a tower up. So I did a balloon test to make sure that the optics would not be excessive. We have very high trees here in New Hampshire. Most of them are about 90 feet tall, and the tower just kind of peeks out over the top of the trees. And the only person that really sees is my next door neighbor. So my inspector asked me to talk to him about it. And it turned out I discovered he was an advanced class ham who had let his license lapse. So you talk about luck. And literally, you cannot see any of this, even though the very tippy top of the antennas are almost 125 feet. Except for looking at my neighbor, you can't really see that there's a tower back here.
That's great. Andy wants to know when he can operate it remotely, and there's a whole bunch of guys want to know if they can come and operate and visit. So you might have a whole bunch of people on your doorstep. And seriously, do you have it set up to remote operation?
We do for digital operation. I travel a lot on business, and it's very relatively easy to do that. Given everything is computer control, all I have to do is have Anita start the station up here at home. And then I kind of have a remote desktop into the computers here. And since everything is controllable from the computers, I can pretty much run the whole station that way. One of the things on the list when we're done with all the automation is to integrate some kind of device for audio, microphone, speakers, and a CW key so I can do full remote operation. So that is in the plan. It's a little bit of a challenge here. We use SO2R gear to concentrate the microphones and speakers and keys and everything else across all these radios. And so it's a little bit specialized to interface it to that type of equipment. But it should definitely be doable. It works great for digital.
Now, Anita, tell us, how many countries have you worked? And you give us a few details of what you've accomplished with this station. It's overwhelming to me, I'll tell you. But let everybody know a little bit about what you've done with this great station.
Okay, I just worked my 200th country over the weekend. And I've been doing a lot of RIDI contesting. I was number 5 in the world in a BART G RIDI contest, which was almost exactly a year ago. And then Fred has I have my DXCC in digital phone and mixed, and Fred has a 5-band DXCC, and he's also got the WPX Award of Excellence.
Wow, that is just amazing. When you think about it, 5-band DXCC, that is an amazing accomplishment. It took a lot of time to do that. You just don't sit down and do that in an afternoon, do you, Fred?
No, you really don't. I probably make, on average, about 100 contacts a week. In a typical contest weekend, many more than that, obviously. Last weekend, I was in the ARL DX phone contest, made just a little under 2,000 contacts in about 25 hours of operating. I think I worked 110 countries and worked 97 in the first 24 hours of the contest.
Well, the next thing you know, Anita's going to start some shortwave broadcasts. I think somebody asked that in the chat room, in MWB. You could certainly start a shortwave broadcast from that station, that's for sure. So that's going to be fun. And you have to tell us a little bit about some of the help you've had. I know that Fred Lloyd has helped you a little bit, who, for everybody, if you remember, Fred is the founder of QRZ, and he's a good friend. And he gave you a lot of tips also, didn't he, Anita?
Okay. Yeah, Fred did a visit to our station a little ways back and spent a whole day with us, kind of giving us all the lore of ham radio from his perspective. He's a really, really interesting guy. He's done a lot of stuff. We've had some other mentors that have helped us. One person in particular I'd like to mention is Scott Anderson, NE1RD. He's kind of my Elmer. And he brought us up the curve, helped us come up the curve much, much quicker than we could have done on our own. So, you know, nobody gets to anywhere in amateur radio without help. And we've been really lucky to have some folks that would have helped us an awful lot.
Well, that's great. Well, I really appreciate you spending time. We'll have to come back and visit again and maybe do a show from there. That would really be cool. And I have one last question, Fred. Do you come home from work to a hot transmitter and a cold stove?
There are definitely times when there's a contest weekend when I am the QSO slave, if you want to look at it that way. When Anita gets in the middle of one of these big contests, it's pretty much up to me to make sure the station's ready to go and everything works and there's food and all the rest of it. But, you know, honestly, I'm really fortunate that she's interested in amateur radio and operates right alongside of me. It would not have been possible to do something like this without all the support that she's given me. And quite frankly, it's great that she enjoys it as much as I do.
Absolutely. And she was your tower engineer. I love it. Well, thanks so much for being with us. And we'll everybody be sure you go to their site. They have some incredible statistics there. So be sure you go check out their site and look through more and more of this. We just didn't have time to run it all, but they've got a really great site set up and I really enjoyed going through it. I've been through it several times. Thanks very much for being with us. And we'll look forward to catching you on the air sometime. Just listen, there'll be some little bitty weak guy from the Ozarks calling you, and that'll be me. So,
all right, Bob, we'll look for you. We'll make sure we listen for you in the pileup.
Yeah, well, just tell everybody, stand by. We got this friend. He's some little weak guy. Let's see what's going on. We won't have any trouble hearing you, I'll guarantee you. So thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you again soon, and we'll appreciate you being here. So bye-bye for now, and go fire up those transmitters, Anita, and see what happens, okay? So long, everybody.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, bye-bye. Oh, man. Hey, George, what do you think? Will we start burning our stuff up and starting over? What do we do?
I think we need to, Bob. I've been in a lot of broadcast stations that weren't nearly laid out as nice as that is.
Isn't that, wasn't it wonderful? I figured you would probably like that. Yes. Hey, I had an email from somebody, you and I talk about this a lot. And I think Brian might even have a copy of this. It was from KI0EO. And he's talking about he'd been battling an RFI problem forever with his computer speakers and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're talking about grounding, and I'm not going to get real carried away because everybody seems to flame me on this. Well, not everybody. Here's one that didn't because he got it. And we're not talking about making your station dangerous. What we're talking about is making sure it's grounded once. And George, I think you probably can agree to this. His salvation was the little UL-approved ground lift. He plugged his computer speakers into that, and then everything stopped. His RFI was gone, only because he eliminated his ground loop. Yeah, it was still grounded, but only through one ground. And so I appreciate Don sending that in. And George, I think we talked about it too. You've solved a few RFI problems with this little guy, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, Bob. You know, my rule of thumb when you're trying to get rid of a hum or RFI is do whatever works. And this monitor I'm looking at right now, that's what I ended up doing with it. I used a little ground lift adapter on there to lift the ground on it, and it took care of all the hum I was getting whenever I connected a computer or the cable TV or anything else that had a ground coming from somewhere else.
Sure. I just wanted to let people know that there's a lot of guys that are listening and doing this properly. So I thought we'd throw that in there. I think we have a nice word from ICOM, so let's go see what ICOM's got, and then we're going to go smoke and solder. So get her ready, George, while we listen to ICOM.
HF, VHF, or UHF, ICOM has you covered wherever you go. Check out the IC7410 and IC7200, two HF radios that employ ICOM's signature DSP technology. The IC7410 is an all-mode HF transceiver. It's got dual convergent super heterodyne system, a built-in auto-tuner, and built-in 15 kHz first IF filter and optional 3 kHz and 6 kHz filters. The IC7200 offers solid performance and digital flexibility. It also includes selectable filter width and shape, excellent receiver performance, and it's compact and rugged, even with a water-resistant front panel. And when it comes to mobiles, have you considered the V8000 for your next adventure on 2 meters? It's got 75 watts of power output in a rugged die-cast aluminum chassis, fast memory channel scanning with dynamic memory scan, complete radio control in the palm of your hand with the versatile mic, backlight customization, and weather scan alert and amateur radio first. And let's not forget ICOM's line of D-Star handheld radios, too. The IC92AD is one rugged VHF-UHF dual bander. Its submersible construction can withstand harsh outdoor elements, dual watch capability, a built-in voice recorder in DV mode, and optional GPS mic. It's great for MCOM and search and rescue. The IC80AD is another dual bander with extended receive coverage. It's the handheld companion to the ID880H mobile rig that I use, and it's an affordable option for hams interested in trying D-Star. It's durable and splash-proof, and it has NOAA weather radio pre-programmed. The UHF D-Star ID31A has so many features for on-the-go operation. It's got built-in GPS. It's compact and lightweight with waterproof construction. It's got a micro SD card slot and repeater list up for quick access to nearby D-Star repeaters. So make sure you visit ICOM America/HF-VHF-UHF for more information on ICOM's line of on-the-go radios.
Yeah, and you know, ICOM invites you to tune in and win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation. And register to win. You could win some great swag prizes from the ICOM swag store, or you could win a monthly radio that they're giving away. And for March, the grand prize is going to be the ICOM IC88D, a dual band VHF UHF handy talkie with 5 watts of power, D-Star digital voice, wideband receive, and more. So go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation after the show this evening and after every episode of Ham Nation, and register to win. And I just noticed somebody is gaming over here on my HF rig. I thought I was on 40 meters, but apparently somebody has hacked in over HF. Well, you know, MFJ just came out with the new MFJ 259C antenna analyzer. They've updated it a little bit. They've added more bands to it. It'll go all the way down to the AM broadcast band now. And I wanted to play with this thing, so I came up with a project for us to do this week. Let's say you got a piece of coax with no markings on it, and you want to know what impedance it is. Well, let's pretend there's no markings on it. How would you go about doing that? Well, if you've got one of these MFJ 259 antenna analyzers, this thing's kind of stood the test of time. This is the latest model, MFJ-259C, where they've added lower frequency ranges on it, and it also covers the 220 band. How would you do this? Well, it's pretty simple. First, let's measure a known cable so we know how this thing works. Here's a piece of RG58-U. We'll need a load to put on here so that we can test. Let's just take a look at a couple of loads, though. This is a terminator from the old thin Ethernet connections where we had to put a 50-ohm terminator on the end of it. This one, 52 ohms, zero reactance. As we switch around through the different frequency bands, it's pretty much holding around 52 ohms there. Now let's take a look at another load. This one is an old Radio Shack CB load that they used to sell. It's nothing but a 2-watt resistor soldered up inside. 37 ohms and 11 ohms of reactance. If we come on down in frequency where it was meant to operate, well, it's 50 ohms with 5 ohms of reactance. You'd rather see that reactance on zero. Not terribly bad, but not perfect either. Now, to do our test here on the transmission line, we're supposed to use a load that's, you know, somewhere in the range that you suspect the cable's impedance will be, but I'm going to use a 100-ohm resistor here, and I've just got it hooked to the end of a BNCT here. Let's just look at it and see what it measures. 108, 111 ohms with some reactance here. That's because this thing is just kind of hanging out in the open. I measured it with an ohm meter, and it was 111 ohms. As we change frequencies, though, we can see it's starting to change impedance a pretty good bit. Nevertheless, that's what we're going to use for our test. What we do is connect our load to one end of the coax, connect the other end of the coax here to the 259B. And, you know, this is one reason I like this analyzer. There's a lot of new fancy analyzers with graphic displays on them and such, but this one just does more measurements than you can do with most others. We start on the lowest frequency that we've got, and what we're going to look for here is nulling the resistance and reactance at the same time. That doesn't mean that it's going to go to zero. We're looking for a null. That's a dip. So we'll start now at our lowest frequency on the analyzer, 530 kilohertz, and we'll start sweeping through, trying to find a null. No null there. Let's sweep back down through this band. None there. Starts dropping there, but I wouldn't really call that a null. A little drop here, but I think we can do better than that. Let's go up to the next range here, 11 to 28 megahertz. Let's see if we can find a null. Now, we notice the reactance dropped to zero right there, but the resistance was going up at that point. It wasn't nulling. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay, 0 ohms of reactance. That's as low as it can get. 27 here on resistance. Let's see if that was a null point on it. Okay, as the reactance starts going up, so does the resistance. Let's go the other direction. Same thing. So there's our null right there. Now, we need to press the gate and make sure that the phase angle equals zero. And it does. Now we need to tune up in frequency and look for a peak in impedance with the X still being nulled. And that looks like the peak there, R100, X equals zero. Again, we press the gate and phase angle still equals zero here. So our first reading was 27. This time we've got 100. Now we can calculate the impedance of the line. 27 times 100 is 2700, and we take the square root of that number, and it says 51.96 ohms. That's not bad. This is a 50-ohm cable, but if you look on Wikipedia, it says that RG58/U is either 50 or 52 ohms. So it looks like this test worked. Now let's try it on our unknown cable, and we'll do the same thing here. Start at the lowest frequency and look for the null on both resistance and reactance. Not there. 0 ohms of reactance here. Let's watch the resistance as we tune either side of that. One. If we go past it, it starts increasing. So let's just see. Perhaps that is a null. So we'll say resistance here is 48. And now let's look for a peak. But first we need to press that gate. Yeah,
okay,
phase angle still 0 degrees here. There it is right there. And reactance is zero. Look at our gate. Phase angle still zero. So that's 108, we'll call it. 48 times 108. Take the square root of that. It says this is a 72-ohm cable. This is RG6. So supposed to be 75 ohms, That's pretty close. So we can say for pretty much certain this is a 75-ohm cable. We wouldn't mistake it for a 50-ohm. So there you go. How you can measure the impedance of a coax using an antenna analyzer. And there's so many things you can do with an antenna analyzer, and we'll be looking at a few more of them in the future. Right now, though, I got a question for Bob. Bob, have you ever had any of this before?
I have not. No, Is it? No, that's very special stuff, right?
Yes, this is Vegemite. It's it came from my friend Peter in Australia. And this is something that the kids use on their toast in the morning. They take a piece of buttered bread and mother smears a little of this stuff that looks like axle grease on it. It's chocked full of vitamins, and it smells like vitamins in here in the room when I open it up. But anyway, Peter sent some of this and some other Australian treats to Tommy and myself, and we sampled this on the last Amateur Logic. And we also did a few other things. Tommy took one of those Arduino microcontrollers and built a heads-up display for his Yaesu rig. But you could also do it with any rig that'll support cat commands. And Peter showed us how he does his recording down under. And I did a little introduction on to easy methods of decoding some digital modes for those who are new into amateur radio or for those who aren't even hams yet but have a shortwave receiver. So if you get a chance, go over to amateurlogic.tv and take a look at that. This stuff right here, I'm not going to tell you what the jury was on it. I suspect if you ask anybody who's tried it before, though, you can find out pretty quick. Yes, if you look at the picture there, at the expressions on our faces, I wanted to draw devil's horns on Peter there. But anyway, he sent us some other goodies to wash it down with afterwards. And it was an experience. That's all I'll say about that. Well, right now, let's give away something. You know, last week I asked a question, what's another name for a diode? And I got a question from Lee Alder on there, KK4SXX. And he said another name for a diode is a rectifier. So congratulations, Lee. We're going to send you this MFJ 24-hour clock, which needs setting. That's optional. You'll have to set it yourself when you get it. But for next week, we've got another great question here. And this is a pretty simple one. What electrical component exhibits negative reactance? And if you think you know the answer to that, send your answer to me at hamnationcontest@gmail.com. And you could win this copy of Morse Code Breaking the Barrier from MFJ, written by Dave Finley, N1IRZ, a great book on getting your Morse code speed up to snuff. And right now, let's bring Don in here and see what's going on in the world of amateur radio.
Hey, George, how you doing? I'm wearing my my lucky shirt tonight because St. Patrick's Day is coming up. My son poked his head in a few minutes ago, and normally he doesn't pay any attention to what we're doing here, but he saw the video game on the screen behind it, and he goes, "Oh my God, he's playing Titanfall!" So apparently, you've impressed my son. No video games over here right now, but we do have the news of the week from Amateur Radio Newsline. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1908. These are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, March 12, 2014. The largest ever launch of microsatellites operating in the 437 megahertz band is planned for March 16th, when some 200 tiny Sprite satellites fly into orbit. Bruce Tennant, K6PZW.
A Sprite is a tiny 3.5 by 3.5 centimeter single-board spacecraft that was developed by SAC Manchester, KD2BHC. It has a microcontroller, radio, and solar cells, and is capable of carrying single-chip sensors. They're stacked atop a spring-loaded pusher and secured by a nichrome burn wire system. On reaching orbit, KickSat will perform a detumble maneuver and establish communication with Cornell University's ground station. After checkout, the spacecraft will be put in a sun-pointing attitude and spun up to maintain that attitude. Then a command signal from the ground station will trigger the deployment, and the Sprites will be released as free-flying spacecraft. All of the 200 Sprites operate on a single frequency of 437.240 MHz and use code division multiple access. Due to the low orbit, sprites will have a short lifetime before they re-enter the atmosphere and burn up. In the best-case scenario, the orbital lifetime could be 6 weeks, but realistically it may be considerably shorter depending on atmospheric conditions.
You should be able to watch the mission live on NASA TV. And as we wait for the 200 Sprite mega mission, Ham Radio has several more new microbirds on orbit. Here's Jim Dameron in 8TMW.
On Friday, February 28th, astronaut Koichi Wakata, KC-5ZTA, deployed a batch of amateur radio CubeSats from the International Space Station. These include Litwanika Sat-1, LitSat-1, ArduSat-2, UAP-Sat, and the 915 MHz SkyCube. There is yet another amateur radio CubeSat still on the ISS. It's the Peruvian-built Chasqui-1, which was launched to the space station on February 5th. This bird is scheduled to be hand-deployed during a future Russian spacewalk.
Meantime, here on the ground, the ARRL says that it's seeking comments concerning the use of digital modes, especially on the high-frequency bands. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather Emby, KB3TZD.
At its January 2014 ARRL Board of Directors meeting, a resolution was passed which asked for member feedback and input pertaining to the increasing popularity of data modes. The information gathered by this investigation is to be used by the League's High Frequency Band Planning Committee as a means to suggest ways to use our spectrum efficiently so that these data modes may compatibly coexist with each other. The ARRL Board of Directors is now reaching out to the membership and requesting input and thoughtful feedback on matters specific to digital mode operation on the HF bands. The feedback on this matter may include the recent proposal of the ARRL made to the FCC in RM11708. This regarding the elimination of the symbol rate restrictions currently in effect.
Comments must be received no later than March 31st, 2014, to be included in the committee's report to the board at the July 2014 ARRL Board of Directors meeting. Please email your comments to hf-digital-bandplanning@arrl.org. The IARU Administrative Council has designated amateur radio your gateway to wireless communication as the theme for World Amateur Radio Day 2014. This ham radio holiday is celebrated each year on April 18th to recognize the anniversary of the founding of the International Amateur Radio Union in Paris, France, back in 1925. The primary purpose of World Amateur Radio Day is to focus a public spotlight on amateur radio and its benefits to countries and communities. This year, the IARU and its member societies around the world will celebrate the organization's 89th anniversary. And as spring approaches, so does HamFest time. Here's Jim Dameron in 8TMW.
The 2014 Southeastern VHF Society Conference will be held April 25th and 26th at the Hilton Atlanta Northeast in the Atlanta suburb of Norcross, Georgia. The conference will kick off with a luncheon on Friday. During the conference, there will be seminars, sessions, as well as noise figure testing and antenna testing. A banquet with speaker on Saturday evening to close the festivities will also take place. For further information on speakers, agenda, etc., check the link, svhfs.org/conference.html. And if you happen to be in or around this area on Saturday, March the 15th, you are cordially invited to the 30th annual ARRL Charleston, West Virginia HamFest. This event will take place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. local time at the Coonskin Armory, 1707 Coonskin Drive in Charleston, West Virginia. Admission is only $6 at the gate. Ham radio exams will be administered by a VE testing team at 12:30 p.m. If you'd like more information, contact this reporter, Jim Dameron, N8TMW, by email to n8tmw@arrl.net. I hope to meet some of you there.
Thanks, Jim. And by the way, if you're a fan of the ABC television series Nashville, you saw Jim playing the role of the minister officiating at the funeral of Raina James' father, played by Powers Booth. Jim's been in several films, including an uncredited role as a reporter in Forrest Gump. Good stuff, Jim. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news brought to you each and every week for over 35 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW 73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. And speaking of HamFest, I'm going to be at the Acadiana Amateur Radio Association 54th Annual Acadiana HamFest. That's in Rain, Louisiana, over near Lafayette, down in Cajun country. That is this Friday and Saturday. I'm going on Saturday. It's their 54th annual, and it's also the Delta Division Convention, ARRL Delta Division Convention. The cool thing about this HamFest is on Friday night, they have a crawfish boil and a fado dough. If you've never been to a Cajun fado dough and a crawfish boil, it's a big party. you don't want to miss that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to hanging out there with some people. So if you see me over there, come by and say hi. Let's head on over to Kansas right now and say hello to Dale. And it's time for Show Me Your Shack, among other things. Dale, how are you tonight?
Thanks, Don. Tonight, another episode of Show Me Your Shack and part three of what is now an 11-part series covering HF Mobile Operation. First of all, we'd like to thank Jim at Jim's Engraving for the great job he did on the brand new Ham Nation sign you can see just over my shoulder. Jim makes great signs on for your ham shack, and he specializes in blast engraving of glass, ceramic, and crystal. The designs are superior, and the colored LEDs he places in the base will make your Radio Shack spectacular. Well, Jim buys used and dead vacuum tubes also, and you can help him and help the environment by selling Jim your used finals. There's only one stipulation. We have a list here. They must look nice since he uses them in the displays. He's looking for 3-500Zs, 4-1000s, 833As, 304TLs, as well as 304THs, 829Bs, Jan 715Bs, 8247s, and 465s. If you have any of these finals, just contact Jim at jimsengraving.com. As Jim said in his note, cash for your glass is better than glass in the trash. And do check out the video at jimsengraving.com. For now, let's roll Show Me Your Shack for February and March. This is Show Me Your Shack, a look at ham shack photos received during late February and early March. Tom Wayne, WB8N, sent us this photo from the Cuyahoga Amateur Radio Society Club station at Copley Fairlawn Middle School in Copley, Ohio. The club works with students at the radio club station WA8CMS. Here, Gary Dewey, NI8Z of CARS, is logging on to the computer. CARS members help the students at WACMS work the school club roundup. Together, they worked a total of 127 stations, including a few DX stations from both Europe and Canada. Here, Josh, KD8VNZ, a student at Copley Fairlawn, operates the ASU FT990. The club puts 100 watts into a vertical antenna on the roof of the school. Rich, a WB4EHG, sent us this photo featuring a Kenwood TS690S HF transceiver and numerous VHF UHF rigs for local operation. He uses a Heil ProSet Elite. The receive audio is a custom setup that combines all of his HF rigs into one output and compensates for his hearing loss. Gary, NC3Z of Davidsonville, Maryland, uses a Directive Systems 5-element 6-meter Yagi, an 8-element 20 to 10-meter log periodic at 62 feet, and full-size dipoles for 160 through 40 meters. Here's a wide view of Gary's shack where he runs an FTDX 5000 MP with an SDIQ receiver as a pan adapter. It's connected to the transceiver's 9 megahertz IF output. And here's a close-up of the radios. He operates the IC7200 and a vintage Drake TR7 as well as the FTDX 5000. He uses the Heil PR22 for great audio and has a couple of dedicated PCs to run the SDR and DX Labs software. Joe, W1XWX, sent us this photo. He uses a Flex 3000 rig and an ICOM IC7000. His microphone's a PR781. He also operates an ICOM 7200 and an LDG IT100. They both run on battery power in the garage. John, W3END, sends us this shack photo. He's been a ham for 38 years and currently holds a general class license. He plans to go for his extra this year. He has an Elinco SR8T transceiver, a Yaesu FT7800, a Kenwood TS7800, and several other rigs. For antennas, he uses a Hustler 5B TV vertical and a Diamond X50. Well, Tom, KC9 UDA, and Shelley, KC9 VEQ, own this nice shack. They run a Kenwood TS2000 barefoot and use a Heil PR781 microphone. Their antennas include a G5RV and a Comet 2-meter and 440 vertical. Tom's the net controller for the weekly Northwood ARES net, which covers two counties in northwestern Wisconsin. And here's their trusty guard dog to make sure no one breaks in to steal their radio equipment. Peter, PD0HHG in Amsterdam, sends this picture of his small living room shack. He uses an iMac 27-inch computer with a Flex Radio 6500. He has an ICOM IC92E D-Star radio, a Heil PR781, and BM10 headset, as well as several other receivers and scanners. Gary, W6RYO, sent us a link to a Dropbox full of photos. Here's a wide view of his shack with the spare parts supply to the left. This is a closer view of his operating system. A vintage Globe Scout transmitter from the 1950s can be seen to the left beside several new ICOM rigs. And this is a view of Gary's antenna. Doug, KA0MHJ, sends a photo of his daughter Ruth, who just passed her technician exam at the Hiawatha Amateur Radio Club RF Fest in Perry, Iowa. He also congratulates his son Richard, KD0RDS, who just earned his extra license. Well, Brian, KC1MAC, sent this photo of his ham shack. The signature line on his email reads, "Hams don't let other hams get stuck on 2 meters." And here's the shack of Travis, KC9TWX. He uses an ICOM 706 MK2G and several ICOM 2-meter and 440 rigs also. He runs Mirage amplifiers for both 2 and 6 meters. He works slow scan TV and also does some 2-meter work. Travis says they are never too young to start learning ham radio. Here's a collage of photos of his 16-month-old daughter Lily giving his equipment the once over. And that's it for the latest shack photos. We'd like to show your photos here on Ham Nation. So to make sure we do, send them to Ham Nation Videos at twit.tv. For guidelines, well, please do check out hamnationvideos.info. We'll build another compilation of those shack photos in about a month, so make sure to send yours to us at hamnationvideos@twit.tv. Well, it's a new week, and we've got a brand new club website of the week. This week, it's smrclub.com. It's the website of the Short Mountain Repeater Club. It's near Nashville, and it's in the heart of Tennessee. The site was nominated by Dale Miller. He tells us the site is very informative for local hams. There's a schedule of club events, a trading post, and a lot of additional information for hams in the Nashville area. And while we're on the subject, we need additional nominees also for the club website of the week. Just send them to hamnationvideos@twit.tv. And for now, give the Short Mountain Repeater Club site a test drive. You'll find it at smrclub.com. Let's move on now to the third installment of an 11-part video series designed to give you the information you need when considering mobile HF operation. Dan, N9LVS, is producing the videos, Tonight, he tells you all about mobile HF batteries and alternators. Take it away, Dan.
This video is titled Mobile HF Batteries and Alternators. Warning, we're talking about electricity. Use proper precaution. Let's first discuss alternators. Peak amperage rating ranges from 100 to as high as 250. These high output ratings weren't meant for us amateurs. Instead, they're intended to provide the necessary power to defrost your windows, power your navigation system, heat your seats, and all the rest of the accessories we've been accustomed to. In addition, more and more vehicles are being equipped with electrical-driven water pumps, power steering motors, and even power assist brakes. In the old days, all cars were equipped with an ammeter connected between the battery and the generator. Today, a more meaningful indication is a DC voltmeter, but manufacturers rely instead on an idiot light. Since we're not idiots, we need to add a voltmeter to be safe and not stranded with a dead battery. If the vehicle doesn't stay above 13 volts DC or more at 2500 RPM while you're transmitting, you might not have enough reserve power for your rig. Fortunately, most rigs nowadays shut down when the voltage drops below 11.6 volts. The voltage should remain about 14 volts even with the lights and air conditioning on. Because we typically don't run all of our accessories at the same time, there's usually enough capacity left over to power even moderately powered amateur transceivers. In some cases, a lot more. Determining if you have enough capacity isn't all that difficult if you use some basic logic. If your car has a rear window defogger, you have about 30 amps reserve. That is enough for the late model 100 watt transceivers, like the FT100, the FT857D, the IC706, and the IC7000, and even the 200-watt TS480. Talking on the radio while in heavy traffic should be discouraged, due in part to the distraction it causes, when your full attention should be on safe driving. Further, air conditioning, cooling fan, headlights, and slow engine speed all add up to low alternator reserve. When in doubt, err on the side of safety and hang up the mic. If you think you have alternator whine, it should sound like this. Whine can be caused by a large spike in the AC component, as shown on the oscilloscope, a very rare occurrence nowadays, and one which typically turns on the check engine light. This said, almost without exception, alternator whine is caused by a ground loop. In most cases, the whine is only apparent on the transmitted signal, which is another indication of a ground loop problem. If this is the case, chances are the cause in the use of a mag mount or poor RF ground return. Also, Jim Perkins, KB1MVX, came up with a neat little circuit, gets rid of a lot of the noise. And if all else fails, talk to a professional car stereo installer or a mechanic when it comes to your amateur radio installation needs. There are other components that you can add to a car's electrical system to enhance its ability, like auxiliary batteries, battery isolators, and battery boosters. This video is just giving you a quick overview. I hope this video has been helpful. And 73s from N9LVS.
A 73 for now, Dan. Thanks for the great job in this series. Next week, Dan begins a three-part mini-series within the 11-part series. The three parts will be about mobile HF wiring. Well, it's time now to vote for the February winner of the Ham's Choice Award. And this month's winner will receive this ARRL book, Storm Spotting and Amateur Radio, just in time for spring now. Courtesy of our Ham's Choice Award sponsor, that's Mark. He's KB0MOF at the Ham Radio Center in Derby, Kansas. Well, don't forget you'll find permanent links to all of our videos presented here on Ham Nation at hamnationvideos.info. Next week, Dan presents the first in that three-part series. And we are pretty short on videos now, so please send yours to hamnationvideos@twit.tv, and we'll get them on Ham Nation for you. That's it for tonight. Have a great week. Cheryl's standing by with questions from the chat room, but first, we're going to check out things with Don, find out what's hot at Ting. Don, it's all yours.
I'll tell you what's hot at Ting. Thanks. Great segment, by the way, Dale. Awesome stuff. Love the videos, and I love Dan Van Evenhoven stuff. Ting is got some cool things going on. In fact, something new I'm going to tell you about from Ting that involves something with Apple. Ting is a reseller of the Sprint network. That's what they do. And what they do is they save you money. You can have as many devices as you want on one plan with the shared pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes, and every device on your plan just costs a flat $6 a month. And the rates just got better. Now, Ting has gotten better pricing from Sprint, and they're going to pass that savings along to you, the customer. Nothing fancy, just better rates, lower monthly bills. If you've already tried Ting's savings calculator to see how much you could save, you might want to do another calculation and see just how much more you could be saving. And as always, no contracts with Ting. You pay only for what you use each month with your megabytes, your messages, and your minutes all broken out and billed separately. There are no add-on charges. That's right. Your voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way, call forwarding, all the other stuff is all right there. No add-on charges. And it's truly and completely contract-free. There's no early termination fees or any of that other BS either. They'll even credit you if you're paying an ETF to come to Ting. They give you a 25% credit on your ETF up to $75 per device just for coming to Ting. You can find out more about that at ting.com/ETF. And again, they charge you only for what you use, plus whatever taxes they are legally required to collect. No hidden charges, no recovery fees, none of that. And you can take total control of your account, your usage, your bills, the powerful online control panel, they're online. Also, if you need to talk to someone, which you probably won't ever, but if you do need to, there's a happy person ready to take your call at 855-TING-FTW, and that's available 12 hours a day, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. EST. That's Eastern Standard Time for those of you down here in South Louisiana. And a real live person will actually pick up the phone, and you can also do all kinds of things at help.ting.com. Active customer support forums, simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, video startup guides, and a whole lot more. Here's how it works. You purchase your mobile device from Ting. That will give you 2 to 5 business days. You'll get that in 2 to 5 business days. Or you can even bring over your favorite Sprint phone. Now, check this out. I've got an iPhone 5 right here in front of me. You can see I've got QST on my iPhone 5, if Brian comes back to me real quick. You can bring your 4 and your 4S, and now you can also bring the iPhone 5 to Ting. Full list of eligible phones. You can find that by going to the show special URL. Click on the BYOD link right at the top of the page. Ting will even help you turn your old device into cash. To help you move to Ting, you can port your number over. You can get a new one, whatever you want to do. Ting will break out your rates by minutes, texts, and megabytes, bill you at the end of the month for what you've used. I want you to do it right now. Wait till after the show. Hamnation.ting.com. Find out how much money you can save. Better manage your mobile phone, your usage with Ting. Check out the savings calculator. See just how much you or your company can save. I had another unsolicited Facebook friend of mine hit me on Facebook last week and say, I just switched to Ting. I'm saving a ton of money. You can do the same thing, too. And since you're a Ham Nation viewer, you'll save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. It is hamnation.ting.com. So sign on and start saving lots of money today with Ting. And man, if you've got an iPhone 5, you can bring it to Ting. We're going to go to Cheryl now with the chat room. And look at that. There's the QST on the iPhone 5. And, you know, you can tell it's a 5 because it's got all those funky icons on the front. Cheryl, what kind of phone do you have? You have Ting, Cheryl? If not, you need
Ting. You know what? I don't have Ting just yet, Don, but I'm kind of looking at it. It seems pretty interesting there. I see you got a lot of information about it. Seems like a pretty good deal there. By the way, I like that lucky shirt. Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's my lucky shirt.
Sounds good.
And it's green. It's my favorite color.
Well, you know, we've got some special effects going on tonight over my right shoulder. You see something a little bit different. I'm really not sure how they're doing that, but it's pretty interesting. A little bit of test patterns and some other things. So very nice, Twit, and there's a reason for that. And I'm going to let you guys figure out what's going on here. It does actually work. So here you go. Anyhow, I want you to tune in to the After Show QSO tonight on 75 meters with me. I'll be waiting on 3.847 megahertz. The ham operators were very nice to clear the frequency. David did that for me, and I wanted to just mention that first. And let me dig down deep into my email bag and talk to Gordo. Hey, Gordo, are you there?
I am here, Cheryl. Good to see you and your animation.
Yeah, great. What is your take on the Chinese handhelds that I'm seeing that run around $45 to $65, dual band, you know? Is it a good deal or a bad deal for a new ham? What do you think?
Well, you know, the Chinese handhelds coming in at $45 through Amazon and a little higher through some of the ham dealers, they're good basic radios. So they're good for hams that know how to program them, that have purchased the RT systems programming software and so on. But for a new ham that gets a Chinese handheld that is not programmed, they've had it. They don't know what repeaters to put in. They don't know how to do the programming, the minus and the plus offsets. It's not automatic. So may I suggest that if you're outfitting a whole group of hams, then get them pre-programmed and in their hands, but show them how to go into VFO and to go up and down. And don't just give them alphanumerics on these Chinese handhelds, but rather frequencies. So if someone says, let's go to 146.52, they'll know how to get there. So the Chinese handhelds are good, but they are not specifically designed for the brand new ham that has no clue on programming. Back to you, Cheryl.
Oh, sure. Oh, thank you, Gordo. That's good to know, and we appreciate that. And there is one more I have for you here, it seems. On tonight's photo story on off-center fed Wyndham antennas, we understand the advantage of five bands of operation. So what are the disadvantages, Gordo, on a Wyndham versus a common single-band dipole? Gordo, okay. Over to you.
As we talk about the Wyndham, I'll just finish with the handhelds. This coming Saturday, Clint Bradford is going to be programming these Chinese handhelds for a lot of brand new hams, and they're going to be very happy when they get that new load at the Palm Springs Ham Fest. Now, Wyndhams are very specifically tuned and balanced with a 4-to-1 ballon, a current ballon, and if they are held next to anything metal, it throws them off. So the big thing about a Wyndham is don't be surprised if you get it up, it's in the clear, and it doesn't quite fall on each one of the bands. It's very sensitive to 10 and 15 and 20 meters. So if you're going to do a Wyndham, I hope you have a HF transceiver, such as an ICOM, with a built-in automatic antenna tuner. That'll get that Wyndham really putting out the power. Back to you, Cheryl.
And one last note on that Wyndham, Gordo. I just was at our ham radio club last night, and someone did a special talk on putting up a tower, and they put that Wyndham up actually next to their tower, and they said, not a good idea. They found out the hard way after it was already up that it definitely interfered with their all-aluminum antenna structure. So I wanted your last comment on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You got to keep that 4-to-1 current ballon, which is at a strong current point on each of the bands. You got to keep it away from anything metal, and you probably want to get one of the line isolators that'll help that antenna tune up. And let's hope that you have a HF radio with a built-in automatic antenna tuner.
Perfect. Hey, thanks, Gordo. You're looking good there, guy. And let's move on. Let's see what else other good chat room questions I have for the gang here. Bob, I definitely have some goodies for you here. So let's move on to a question from KA2OFM for Mr. Bob Heil. Actually, is Ham Nation going to be at the ARRL Centennial Celebration? He wanted to know. Bob?
We don't have Bob online right now.
All right. Well, pardon me.
Gordo will
Okay,
yeah,
go ahead, Gordo.
I'm going to be there, Cheryl. So we look forward to seeing everybody. So we'll bring a little bit of Ham Nation to the ARRL convention. So you can count on me, and I know others representing Ham Nation are likely to be there as well. Back to you, Cheryl.
Well, how very nice. Thanks for picking that up, Gordo. Appreciate it. And here's one from KC9UDA, and I think I'm going to field that with a backup of Gordo for the secondary to back me up here. He asked in the chat room earlier, should he hook his power supply to the wall plug or the power strip? Which one is best? I say plug it into a power strip rather than just the wall plug, as long as it's not daisy chained into another power strip. You know, the MOV doesn't work if it's in series, after all. So it's best to get a power strip with a high joule rating overall. That's your best choice. Wouldn't you agree with me on that, Gordo?
I would. You're absolutely correct. And keep it real simple and be able to unplug it and plug it into the wall, maybe, if you're having hum. And then, as Bob suggested, a little adapter that pulls the ground off of that particular piece of equipment that may already be grounded via a regular ground strap.
Okay, very good. Thank you again. And, George, are you online with us tonight? Are you there?
I am, Cheryl. Hi.
Hey, greetings. Nice to see you. I do have a question for you. There's actually two here from one of our chat roomers, KD2EPQ. Pierre, he says, number one, he has played with the MFJ-259C analyzer. No, have you played with the MFJ-259C analyzer yet? That's the first question. Over to you.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did that tonight on Smoke and Solder. So yes, I have.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, thank you for that. And what is his second question is, what is the filing cabinet marked top secret? And does he need some?
Well, I could tell him, but I would have to kill him. So we won't let that out.
Hey, well, at least somebody noticed that. I think that's pretty good. And last question for you is from Tim, WB3HBX. Thank you for your question. He says, can he buy an inductor tester to measure inductance? He can't find one anywhere. What do you recommend?
You can use this right here. And that's the MFJ-259C. It will check inductors, capacitors, a lot of different things. But what you would look for, I believe, would be an impedance bridge. You don't see them as much anymore, but that's normally what you would check inductors and capacitors and such with. Or an LCR meter. An LCR meter would probably do it, too.
And where would one find an LCR meter? Anywhere?
Yeah, just about anywhere that sells meters. There's a lot of them out there by Fluke and Leader and a lot of cheaper ones, too. I haven't used one myself, so I don't know how good the cheap ones are.
Okay, so they do range in price considerably, and there's the top brands versus on down, but you might not need the top brand if you don't use it all the time. I would think that might be the case.
Yeah, and you want to check the ranges on it, too, because some of them won't, you know, they won't cover all the values that you might want to measure. I've noticed that on some of the inductance meters. That's why I have not ordered them. It's because some of those LCR meters won't go quite down to the size of inductor I want to measure.
All right. And thank you very much for your answers, Gordo and George. And last but not least, I just wanted to put this out there for Dale. I know he's not online, but if he would please answer VE3MIC, Mike wanted to know, is he replayed his video once, and he thinks that's an alpha linear amp that we see on his shack on the right. So if he could, Dale, if you're listening, if you want to just type that into the chat room, that would be great for VE3MIC Mike. I didn't ever want to not get that answered, but it's hard for me to ask you directly because we're not all connected at the same time. But thank you very much to the TWIT staff for having a little fun with me tonight. It was great. And to you, Gordo, and George and Don, you did a great job. So everyone, please stop by on 3.847 megahertz for the 75 meter after show QSO net. I'll be looking to talk to you. And we'll see you next week right here on Ham Nation. Thanks so much for being here tonight with me and us. 73.
Thanks, Cheryl. Good to see you tonight. I guess Bob has left the building, Brian.
So that's good.
I think he has, and I hear excitement on 7278, so that's where I'm going to be. And thanks, everyone in the chat room, for tuning us in tonight. So 73 from Southern California, Palm Springs, here we come. Over to you, George.
All right, Gordo, good to see you and everyone tonight. I'm involved in a little game over here right now. So, we're closing the show. Okay, the nets tonight, Gordo gave you the 40-meter. There is no 20-meter net tonight. Steve is out of town but should be back next week. Echo Link is on star do drop in star or node number 355-800. And you can catch the D-Star net on Reflector 14 Module C. Well, that's it for tonight. Join us again next week at the same time for another exciting episode of Ham Nation. Until then, 73.